You're listening to a talk by scholar and policy analyst Kristen Dawkins on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Now we continue with a conclusion of Biotechnology, Battle Royale of the 21st Century. This is Unwelcome Guests.
Monsanto is very active in the rest of the world. It has formed agreements with a number of private foundations to bring genetically engineered technologies to Africa in particular, but also to elsewhere, in order to feed the hungry and allow them to bring themselves out of poverty. The United States AID, AID, Agency for International Development, just recently gave Mozambique, where these tremendous floods are killing thousands and thousands of people, a huge quantity of seeds to help them to rebuild their agriculture. Anyone want to bet that those are genetically engineered seeds? I don't know that for a fact, but I take a bet. It's not a coincidence that Africa has led the opposition to the United States and the rest of the Miami Group in various international negotiations to try to defend biodiversity and biosafety. The Ethiopians in particular have led the entire African group in this initiative. I don't think it's a coincidence that Ethiopia is very, very familiar with famine. Oddly enough, they also have one of the most, if not the most, sophisticated gene bank in the world. And they are striving mightily to develop the soft path towards food security and development. Whether or not they will be allowed to do so, as the United States and these agribusiness chemical pharmaceutical conglomerates market their wares and use these international institutions to force other countries to allow these products into their markets and into their ecosystems, remains to be seen. Food security really fundamentally depends on genetic diversity. Even though here in Ithaca and in Minnesota and in a whole lot of universities around the United States, there are scientists using materials from the other gene banks, Fort Collins, the United States big gene bank, public sector, and the other ones that make up this international system of agricultural research centers, they depend on renewing their stock with wild varieties every so often. If there are no wild varieties with which to commingle through traditional breeding methods, getting fresh DNA into a more narrow stock that has been contained for some time, not allowed to evolve along with climate change and soil conditions and so forth out there in nature. If we lose that genetic base in the wild, it's very unlikely that our scientists can continue to develop the kind of improved varieties that we assume are the basis of the food system. Biopiracy, the taking of those wild varieties by corporations using anthropologists and other sorts of researchers who enjoy going into these remote areas, getting to know the local people, getting to know their religious and food and health medicinal practices, and taking the plants that they discover through those communications with the local people back to the laboratory, and then taking the active ingredients, developing a synthetic, marketing a product, whether we're talking about a food product or a pharmaceutical. This is being called biopiracy now by those countries who are beginning to recognize the incredible value of their wild gene pools. There are numerous cases 147 have been documented by RAFI, the Rural Advancement Foundation International, cases in which the local knowledge of indigenous or other traditional peoples has been taken back to the laboratory and patented, made the private property of the corporation that had the resources and wherewithal to send the anthropologist out and bring back the material and do some tinkering around with the genes so that they could declare some kind of a novel invention that makes it a legitimate patentable product under United States patent law. This is being called biopiracy. One of the most egregious cases, I don't know how many of you saw it, was reported in the New York Times recently, in which a company called Podners, based in the United States, in 1994, only 6 years ago, went to Mexico and bought a bunch of yellow beans in the market. And they came back to the United States and they selected among those yellow beans for the most yellow ones. And after 5 or 6 years of this selection process, they had a really super yellow bean, and then they patented it. And they said, this yellow bean now belongs to the Podners company, and if the Mexicans have any beans that are quite that yellow in their stock, they owe a royalty now to this company. Well, Mexico is getting kind of interested in this patent, and there may well be a dispute. We'll see about that. Now, the whole concept of intellectual property rights and patents has a great deal of merit. The other side of the coin is the argument I'm going to make here, in particular related to life forms. There's something questionable ethically about privatizing something that's living and declaring that it is the private property of a single corporation and that no one else can use that life form for any purpose without paying the patent holder some royalties. An example that I would like to, I guess, make here, and this is getting me towards the end of my comments, would be the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company, which is, you know, one of the very, very, very giant companies, has been developing some AIDS drugs, and they have got a patent on this new drug called Diflucan, which shows a great deal of promise for helping AIDS victims to survive. They, in South Africa, well, this is information from the Nobel Prize-winning nonprofit organization Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. The Pfizer company invested $3 billion in South Africa on the development of Diflucan and has already earned $6 billion on sales of this drug. And they're producing it in Thailand. Each pill, I guess it's a pill, costs 3 rand. And they're selling it in South Africa for 36 rand each. So there's some very, very huge orders of magnitude here in terms of the actual costs and the actual revenues that the Pfizer company is earning on this drug against AIDS. When you have a patent, no other company, unless they pay you, can develop that same technology. And increasingly, researchers are not releasing the information that they learn along the research way because they want to be first in line for the patent. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this problem. Here in the universities, there's a serious trend against publishing early in order to make sure that the university itself is the first one to the patent office. This undermines the ostensible objective of intellectual property rights, which is to stimulate innovation in order to reach the goal of curing AIDS or curing cancer or what have you. It's a reversal of the entire incentive structure for which intellectual property rights were designed. I'd suggest that there is an alternative model that we might consider. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the electric utility regulatory system in this country, but they have a so-called natural monopoly, and one company serves a very large area, and there's no competition. So the basis on which our government has decided that they should be regulated so that they're not taking advantage of that monopoly to rip off the public is that each state in the United States creates a public utility commission or a public service commission or something like that. They're often elected, they're often appointed by other public officials, but it is a public body, and on an annual basis they bring the company into a public meeting and they request the company to open up their books, and not to give away any trade secrets, but to demonstrate what their investments in research have been, what their investments have been in new plant and facility, to really show that the money that they collect from the consumers is actually put into providing service to the consumers. And if the company is doing a good job of that, then this public agency says, "You're a great company. You get a good reward. 14% return on investment above and beyond your costs." And then that's averaged out for the number of ratepayers in a particular service area, and that's what we pay to have electricity. The same thing could be done with pharmaceuticals or other kinds of research and development needs in the public interest. In Seattle, one of the issues that didn't get much media attention was the intellectual property rights issue. And the one success there, although since the entire meeting was derailed, it's not on the books, but it will be carried forward, was that all of the governments agreed that there should not be patents on the list of essential drugs that the United Nations World Health Organization lists as essential to human health. That's a major change to say that those drugs should not be patented. Remains to be transferred into actual implementable law, but we shall see. The other hot issue in the intellectual property rights negotiations is whether or not there should be patents on seeds, and patents on plants, and patents on animals, and patents on human beings. There are some already. These negotiations are ongoing. After Seattle, there's a whole new spirit, and there are governments prepared to hold the line. Once again, it's the African governments that have taken the strongest position and argued that the World Trade Organization should prohibit all patents on life. After Seattle, there's a whole discussion that's opened up about the nature of global governance. Should a multilateral institution have as much power as the WTO has to overrule national governments who, through their domestic democratic procedures in Congress or in Parliament, through administrative procedures, through the painstaking give and take of our public debate, should those decisions made in a democracy be overruled by an institution that is fundamentally anti-democratic? On the other hand, there are times in which an international decision does need to be made and does need to be applicable worldwide. I would cite climate change as perhaps the most obvious of those issues. We truly need a global process for figuring out how to deal with certain global problems. There's a big agenda of international meetings coming up later this year, In Geneva, there's ongoing negotiations around the WTO issues. In France, in November or December, there will be the first meeting to follow up on the new International Biosafety Protocol. In Nairobi, in May, there will be the fifth conference of the parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, where the issues of indigenous peoples' rights and how traditional knowledge can and should be juxtaposed to intellectual property rights. Those negotiations are in May in Nairobi. Also in May in Dresden, the CGR, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, the collection of these 16 gene banks, they will be having their annual meeting, and it will be preceded by a meeting with the non-governmental sectors from all over the world to talk about the role of agricultural research in particular and the distinction between public interest science and private interest science is at the top of that list. Increasingly, all over the world, GMOs and genetic engineering is at the heart of all of these negotiations. Consumers and environmentalists, farmers, both conventional farmers and certainly peasant farmers where they have an organizational voice, are saying they don't want GMOs. I would argue that it's not hysteria, and I would argue that it's even not really about science. It's about the structure of our economies, the future of our societies. It's about the survival of the planet and the survival of cultures, the relationship of people to their land and resources. It's the battle royale of the 21st century. Science has a very crucial role to play in how this unfolds. Whether it can stand the privatization challenge is the question that we have before us. C.P. Snow asked this question in 1959, whether by the year 2000 we will have solved the problem of poverty through our scientific knowledge. So far, the answer is quite obviously no. 41 years later, I'll close by quoting the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, the Most Reverend Nyongokulu Winston Hugh Ndungani. I'm not sure that that's how it's pronounced. It's my best shot at it. He wrote in a letter dated March 13th of the year 2000, just a week ago, to the chairman and chief executive officer of the Pfizer company, Mr. William C. Steer, Jr. I only quote a sentence or two. "Creativity is needed to bridge the huge gap between human need, scientific effort, and market returns. Both rich and poor need to direct their attention towards a common plan of action regarding mobilization of science and technology for poor country problems." 41 years after C.P. Snow, it sounds very similar. How about it? Do we think that by the year 2041, 41 years from now, we will have solved the problem of poverty in this world? Let's teach our children well. Thank you very much.
That was scholar and activist Kristen Dawkins speaking at Ithaca College last March. Coming up, more GMO news and opportunities for getting involved to stop GMO contamination in the Finger Lakes.
All the microorganism, all the microorganism. Dive in the gene pool, down you swim, down to where the light grows dim. Flail, little fishies, flail if you can, but avoid the microorganism, man. All the microorganism, all the microorganism. Caffeine and sugar and THC's all the doctors are gonna find in me. When they do the autopsy, the microorganism won't get me. All the microorganism, all the microorganism.
this summer, the New York State Legislature will be holding public hearings on a proposed bill that would ban plantings of GMO crops in New York State for 5 years. The time and place of the hearings has not yet been determined, but the fact that they are happening at all is the result of energetic activism. Monsanto and other biotech firms are lobbying and spending heavily to defeat the bill. Ithaca's representative, Marty Luster, who also supports the construction of the biotech park in Geneva, has spoken out strongly against the bill on the grounds that it will impede research. If you don't want to be, or want your food to be, the guinea pig for this sort of research, Luster needs to hear from you. If you live outside of Ithaca, your state assembly member also needs to hear from you. Similar legislation is being passed or proposed all over the country, according to a May 25th article by Julie Light for Corporate Watch.
San Ramon, California. Local communities go on record against GE crops. In communities from Berkeley, Petaluma, and Sebastopol, California, to 5 townships in Pennsylvania, to the city of Boston, Massachusetts, coalitions of parents, farmers, and environmentalists have gotten local legislators to pass an array of anti-biotech resolutions. Some, like the one passed unanimously by Boston City Council in March, urged the federal government to require labeling of genetically engineered foods. Others, like Sebastopol's, support federal legislation calling for a moratorium on genetically modified organisms unless they are proven safe. The resolutions are non-binding, but they are meant to educate the public and send a strong message to the biotech corporations and the federal government. Community activists have been convening town meetings and participating in the local political process, often helping to draft measures. Activists say they are reclaiming the political process. What we've been trying to accomplish in different parts of the country is local democracy, explains Dave Henson, director of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Sonoma County, California. We can't do this at the national level because corporations control the political process, adds Henson, who has been involved in various local initiatives as well as national strategizing. May 18th, the Austin City Council adopted a very strongly worded resolution calling for a moratorium on GMO foods and supporting federal legislation mandating labeling.
Advanta, a British seed company, will be compensating farmers in the UK and France whose crops had to be destroyed after the seed sold by Advanta was found to have been contaminated with GMOs. Other seed companies are moving their operations to avoid GMO contamination, a May 29th London Times article reported.
Firms Move to Avoid Risk of Contamination by Nick Nuttall, environmental correspondent. Some of the world's largest seed companies are moving their operations to countries free of genetically modified production to reduce the risk of contamination. Advanta, the company at the center of the storm over GM impurities in the British oilseed rape crop, said that it had abandoned producing seed in Western Canada because the risk of cross-pollination from GM crops and others was now too high. David Buckridge, the European business director, said the company had moved some of its production to New Zealand, where no GM production takes place, and the rest to New Brunswick in eastern Canada and Montana in the United States. Pioneer Hybrid, which supplies 12% of the British corn crop, has enforced a similar strategy after worries that GM impurities and supposedly non-GM seeds were soaring. Most of its European corn seed production has moved to Romania, Hungary, and Austria. Simon Preece, spokesman for the Pioneer's British operations, said that too many GM crops were being grown in parts of North America. This led to a rising risk of cross-pollination from GM to non-GM seed production and the mixing of seeds at packing centers. With some 40 million acres of GM under cultivation worldwide, we were presented with significant challenges. We decided in 1999 to recite the majority of the maize production in Eastern Europe where there is significantly less GM, he said.
Next weekend, June 16th and 17th, there will be a demonstration on the Cornell campus in Ithaca to protest GMO agriculture and educate people on the risks to health and environment caused by genetic engineering. The protest will take place at Kennedy Hall, where a symposium involving biotechnologists will be taking place. We spoke with Eric Bradshaw, the editor of Groundscore, an environmental and political newspaper published in Retsaf for Central and Western New York. Bradshaw is one of the organizers of the demonstration.
This symposium is called Rice Production in the 21st Century, and Cornell University scientists have experimented for the past many, many years with genetic engineering of food, genetic engineering of rice in particular, and they have helped the biotech industry greatly with an invention called the gene gun, which allows companies to insert genes from radically different organisms into our food, including rice. Rice production has also been helped in the United States with genetic engineering companies by taking rice that has been produced for thousands of years in other cultures and copying the genetic code from it so that they can produce the rice and take a patent out on it, and those countries that produced it originally no longer own it. So there's a couple of different issues we're fighting against here. But basically, we're against genetic engineering of food because it's untested, it's unlabeled, people don't know about it, and we are all being used as experiments. Thousands of different foods now have some genetic engineered content, and it's going to get worse and worse as time goes on. Basically, the FDA, the USDA are co-owners in the patents with companies that are involved in biotechnology. They don't want it labeled because they don't want people to know about it. And we want it labeled. We want people to know what's genetically engineered and what's not. We want it tested. The stuff has never been tested except by the companies who produce it themselves. The FDA doesn't do any testing. The USDA hasn't done any testing. Basically, they just put it out on the marketplace calling it just another food. But we know of many, many cases where that's just simply not true, like BT potatoes. Those are potatoes with pesticides in every single cell of the potato, so that the potato itself is no longer a vegetable but a pesticide. And the FDA says it can't regulate it because the FDA considers it a pesticide. But then the other people who are supposed to regulate pesticides say they can't regulate it because it's actually a potato. So in the end, no one regulates it and no one labels it, and we all eat it without knowing. You never know when you pick up a potato at a grocery store or even a farmer's market whether it's going to be genetically engineered or not. McDonald's actually last year finally told the farmers that grow potatoes for them to stop using genetically engineered material and to stop using genetically engineered potatoes because they were afraid of just this reaction.
Well, surely it can't be legal to sell a pesticide as a food product.
You wouldn't think so, but it is perfectly legal because the FDA are the people, the Food and Drug Administration is supposed to protect us and supposed to tell us what's in our food. They're supposed to test new foods before they come out in the market. But not only have they not tested it and not labeled it, but they're co-owners of the patents that control this technology. So they have a vested interest in not letting people know that there's anything possibly wrong with it. Now, people all over the world have rejected engineered food, genetically engineered food. People in Europe, almost every country in Europe and Canada, some places in Japan have some sort of ban on genetically engineered food, or at least they label it so people can have a choice between not eating it or eating it. Here in the United States, the companies that support and control genetic engineering of food and biotechnology in general didn't want the same mistakes that they made in Europe to happen here. They didn't want people to know about it. They wanted to put it in the base foods so that it goes in almost all the foods we eat. By the time we find out about it, it's maybe years later, and they say, well, you've been eating it for years, so there's no problem. But in reality, it could take many, many years for these unknown effects of genetically engineered food to hit us, and before we really know what's going on, because there hasn't been any long-term tests, there haven't even been any short-term tests. So 5-10 years from now, who knows what effects genetically engineered food might have.
What have the people in Europe done to keep genetically modified crops from becoming basically surreptitiously inserted into their food chain without their knowledge.
People in Europe have done many things. First of all, they're a lot more knowledgeable than most, than your average citizen in the United States. The FDA and the companies that are involved in genetic engineering from the U.S. don't want the Americans to really know what's going on. They want to be able to be the ones to tell the public how genetic engineering food is going to help them. In Europe, people learned a lot earlier about it, and the more people know about it, the more likely they are to be against it. So in Europe, they circulated petitions, they got it out of the grocery stores, they wanted labeling so that they could have a choice between genetic engineered food and non-genetically engineered food, and they've gone a little bit farther. They do something called nighttime gardening, and that means where they have test plots, farms that grow experimental crops like tomatoes, where they insert the genes from fish and North American shellfish in tomatoes to supposedly make them grow in a colder climate. This nighttime gardening are people who basically wear something over their face and wear gloves and go in and cut down the crop. They cut them down, they burn them, so basically they will never get to market. And that's happening all over Europe, a lot of them in England, in Germany, in France, and it has started to spread to the United States. As a matter of fact, I was kind of surprised to learn that Cornell University's gigantic test plots, they have 850 acres around Geneva, New York, where they grow genetically engineered food, they grow genetically engineered trees. I'm kind of surprised that it hasn't happened there, but it has happened in other places in the United States, this nighttime gardening where people will cut down the crops and destroy the technology before it gets to market. Mostly in the western United States right now, it's happening in California and Arizona. I'm pretty sure that it's probably going to spread. The more people learn about it, the more angry they're probably going to get.
What should people know about genetic engineering, and what are they told that is not true or deceptive by those who have an economic interest in perpetuating GMO agriculture?
What people are told is that genetic engineering is merely traditional breeding. All it is a better way. Science has made it easier to breed plants. Crossbreeding is shown as just the same as genetic engineering, and that's just not true. Basically, you know, traditional breeders over the last 5 or 10,000 years have never been capable of crossing fish and strawberry genes, but that's exactly what genetic engineers are doing. They're taking genes from radically different species and inserting it into food for certain properties, like taking North American shellfish genes and inserting it into a tomato so that it can grow in a colder climate. But basically, if you're allergic to shellfish and you eat a tomato, you're going to have no idea that you might have a reaction. Things like the bovine growth hormone that they market to farmers as being able to make a cow produce up to 30% more milk. That's true. The cow might produce up to 30% more milk, but what they don't tell you is that later on, those cows have a very good chance of developing a disease called mastitis, which is a disease that destroys the udders of the cows. And in order to cure that disease, farmers have to use antibiotics. And they inject those into the cows to cure the mastitis, but both of those things can end up in the milk, both the infection and the cure for the infection, which is the antibiotics. So we're drinking all kinds of stuff in our milk, and the thing is, even if you've got several farmers, even if most farmers who are getting milk out of cows don't use this bovine growth hormone, which Monsanto markets as Posilac. The farmers that do use it, the milk is commingled in the same tanks, so you're never really going to know in the end what's been tested for it and what's not. And that's another thing that they say, that all the milk has been tested, and it doesn't really matter because they only test for certain kinds of antibiotics. They might test for 3 out of 35 possible antibiotics that can be used on cows. they might test for 3 or 4 hormones that farmers could use. And farmers know which ones they test for and which ones they don't. So they can very easily get around that, use it to produce more milk. In the end, it might hurt them in the long run, 3 or 4 years down the road, with these udder infections, and also some things happen to the cow's hooves that make them not be able to walk. And they burn out faster. They don't produce milk as long. But basically, you have no way to tell when you pick up a carton of milk in the store whether it's been genetically engineered or not, whether it's got bovine growth hormones in it, whether it's got antibiotics. And if you keep putting antibiotics in milk, it sounds like a good thing, but if you drink that every day, pretty soon the population is going to be, the antibiotics that you would take normally when you get sick aren't going to be as effective.
What you're saying then is for people who are buying the food and eating it, they are getting no benefit and possibly quite a detrimental situation for their health. The farmers who have been promised an economic benefit from using these products are not actually getting one.
No, I don't think so. The poor farmers, there's a lot of single-family farms that are just barely scraping by. The poor farmers aren't doing this because they have any other economic interest other than survival. They are almost willing to use anything that's going to keep their farm afloat and keep them producing and doing the thing that they've been doing, you know, probably in their family for hundreds of years. They're just using whatever they can in order to survive, because right now, company-controlled agriculture is gigantic. It eats up family farms every day. And in order to survive, these seed companies and biotechnology companies are telling the farmers, use our product, you'll get more milk out of the cow, you'll use less pesticides on your soybeans. They say that GMO crops eliminate pesticides and are necessary for environmentally sustainable farming. But the most widely grown GMO plants in the U.S. are herbicide-tolerant crops, like Monsanto's Roundup Ready soy, corn, and cotton. But the reason why they do this, I mean, you got to understand, the same people that are selling you these ready crops, these crops that are resistant to pesticides, are the same companies that produce those pesticides. So if they really wanted you to use less pesticides, this would not be a technology that they're touting. The reason why they want you to buy it is because you're going to end up actually using more pesticides. Now you've got a pesticide that you can spray directly on the plant and not worry about the plant dying from it. However, that ends up in our food supply. We get pesticides that we eat on the crops every day. And they're not just things that wash off. When you genetically engineer a plant, a crop, a seed, that changes the basic structure of that plant. And that changes the basic structure of the foods that we eat. Those companies are putting them in the most basic food groups so that they end up in all kinds of products. They put them in soy and corn and rice, and those kinds of things end up in just about every product that is sold on the store shelves today. Anything that's not just purely naturally grown, even something as simple as a tomato or a strawberry, can be genetically engineered. But if you get into cake mixes or cereals or just about anything on the shelves, they use some of these base products like rice or corn or soy. So it ends up in a lot of the food that we eat. They're very small amounts right now for the most part, but they're going to be getting bigger and bigger.
Unless we stop it.
Unless we stop it now, yeah. One of the big things that they say, these companies that are touting the genetically engineered technology, is that they're doing it so that they can feed the world's hungry. Now, that's just simply not true. A, there's enough food to go around in the world right now today. The problem is not that we don't have enough food. Because if that was the problem, all we'd have to do is open up the grain bins that we store our surplus food in. We'd have to stop dumping it in the ocean. That we do that so we keep the prices artificially high. All over the world, we have plenty of food to feed the world's population. It's economics. It's making a profit. These people can't afford to buy the food. It's not that there's not enough food for them in the first place. So to say that they're using genetic engineering to feed the world's population is ridiculous. One of the biggest technologies that companies like Monsanto has come out with in the last few years is something called the Terminator seed. And that's actually growing a crop and that almost kills itself in the end. It doesn't reproduce. They turn off the sexual genes in the plant. They turn off the reproduction properties so that you will, even if you save that seed from your crop the year before, it won't grow. There won't be any more plants from that plant. You'll have to throw away your seeds. As a matter of fact, the farmers that grow that, they make signed release forms that they will not save the seeds. They have to return the seeds to the companies, and they have to buy new seeds every year. Well, if you're a poor farmer in Africa and you have to buy seeds every year instead of saving at least some of the seeds that you from your plants the year before, how is that going to make you better off economically? It's not. You're going to have to buy seeds every year from those companies. And if every crop is genetically engineered, and by the way, this technology, the genetic engineering code that's in the plants can spread via wind, via pollen, to other plants that are not genetically engineered, so that if you've got an organic farmer living 10 miles away from somebody who's growing genetically engineered food, within a few years, that organic farmer's produce is going to be genetically engineered too, because it spreads. So when they say that they're using this to feed the world's population, it's pretty ridiculous. In 1998, 24 African scientists at a United Nations conference wrote an angry letter about Monsanto's advertising, because Monsanto used photos of starving African children under the headline, "Let the Harvest Begin." In their statement, these 24 African scientists said, "We strongly object that the image of the poor and hungry from our countries is being used by giant multinational corporations to push a technology that is neither safe, environmentally friendly, or economically beneficial to us. We do not believe that such companies or gene technologies will help our farmers to produce the food that is needed in the 21st century. On the contrary, we think it will destroy the diversity, the local knowledge, and the sustainable agricultural systems that our farmers have developed for millennia, and that this will undermine our capacity to feed ourselves. Experts warn that genetic engineering may lead to an increase in hunger and starvation. Because biotech companies are eagerly pursuing a genetic engineering technique named Terminator that would render a crop's seed sterile, making it impossible for farmers to save seed for replanting. If enough food is produced worldwide to feed more than the current population, the problem is rather one of poverty, inequality, and access to food. World hunger is gonna keep going on despite genetic engineering, and in fact, it's probably going to get worse with genetic engineering.
Now, why would anyone in their right mind buy a Terminator seed?
Well, it's a little bit cheaper for the farmers. Right now, they're trying to get it out there, so they're selling it for less, and they promise that those seeds are going to grow crops that are not only resistant to pesticides, the same pesticides that they sell, but that also they're going to be resistant to other things like a drought and certain insects that go after certain kinds of plants. There's a certain insect that really loves potatoes, so they genetically engineer it to be resistant to that insect. In the 1990s and into the year 2000, we're getting genetically engineered crops that are genetically engineered to be resistant to these certain kinds of pests. Well, these pests are going to become just as used to the genetic engineering that's going on in these plants as they were to the pesticides earlier. So what people are afraid are going to happen is you've got crops that are resistant to certain kinds of pests and crops that are resistant to certain kind of pesticides. So you've got both going on at the same time, and here's these pests that are slowly going to become resistant to both of these things. So you're going to end up with basically superbugs, bugs that are resistant to everything we've thrown at them so far. So what's going to come next? The only answer 10 years down the road, when these bugs are resistant to both the pesticides and the genetic engineering that you've put in these plants, is you're going to come out with bugs that are resistant to both, and they're going to be superbugs. It really harms the poor organic farmers that aren't trying to use anything, because now they've got these super bugs that are running around being resistant to everybody else's genetic engineering and their pesticides, and then they come on over to the organic farm 10, 20 years down the road. The biodiversity in America and around the world is just going to be virtually gone.
It seems that as more information about these things get out to the public, the more people know, the less they want it.
They learned in Europe, basically, that the more people know about genetic engineering, the more people know about genetically modified organisms, the more they don't like it, the more they are resistant to it, and the more they actually want to fight it. So what they've done in America is first not told the general public about it. They've not labeled it, so we don't know that we're eating it, and we find out about it slowly. When the genetic engineering companies, when the biotech companies learned that people in America were starting to find out about it, starting to resist, and starting to fight this technology, they decided they were going to spend some money on public relations, which basically means, in America, advertising. And advertising on television will probably be a real big part of that.
How much money?
Well, in March of this year, there was the largest, the biotech industry's largest convention is called Bio 2000. That was held in Boston, Massachusetts. When people found out that they were having this convention in Boston, they decided that they were going to protest it. So they had a protest, a counter-conference to the Bio 2000 conference called Bio Devastation 2000. And 4,000 people were on the street protesting the biotech industry. When 4 days before that conference happened, they found out, the biotech industry found out just how many people were going to be there protesting them. They got together, the biggest companies got together, basically Monsanto and DuPont sponsored a $50 million advertising blitz. That was going to be their the money that they were going to use to, quote-unquote, educate the American public on genetic engineering and biotechnology. When they actually looked down and saw how many people were in the street protesting their conference, they changed their minds. Now it's up to $200 million. So you're going to see a lot of advertising on television and a lot of subtle things. Public relations is not just television advertising. That's the most blatant form of it, and I'm sure we'll see a lot of it. But public relations also is basically, quote-unquote, educating people who put out information in other ways, like educating reporters and educating people who put out magazines and people who are on the news. So if you can convince them of the validity of bioengineering, biotechnology and genetic engineering, then you can, in subtle ways, get messages out. I saw a television advertisement for a stock company, an investment firm. In a very subtle way, they said, well, the new investments are going to come from biotechnology in the 21st century. And they had a little kid making a speech of how he was going to invest in biotechnology. Most people in America, your average Joe, has no idea who Monsanto is. It's not like Kraft or McDonald's. Monsanto is the fourth largest pharmaceutical company and the second largest agricultural company, seed company in the world. But unless you're a farmer, you're probably not going to know their name. So while this Biodevastation 2000 protest was a wonderful thing, it doesn't really help the average citizen understand the problem or understand how many people are against the problem. When you go to the grocery store and you buy a tomato or a potato or practically any product on the store shelves, like Wegmans food you feel good about or Walter's food from Tops grocery stores, you want to know right then and there whether you're getting genetically engineered food or not. And since the FDA doesn't require labeling, and since companies lobby around the country to actually make the labeling of genetically engineered food or not genetically engineered food illegal, you're not going to know. So people are trying to hit the grocery stores, passing out information and getting people some real education on the genetic engineering issues at the point of purchase, at Wegmans, at Tops, at the other grocery stores. They're the first grocery store on the East Coast that has decided that they were going to get rid of genetic engineering food and tell their farmers to stop growing it for their house, for their house brands, their in-store products, was in Pennsylvania. We'd like to spread that to New York. We'd like to get the groups involved to be at the grocery store so that people actually buying the food will know right then and there this food may contain genetically engineered ingredients. We'd like Wegmans and Tops and the other grocery store chains to get genetic engineered ingredients out of their store brands. If you look at a thing of ice cream from Ben and Jerry's, you will see on there where they say they have told their farmers not to use growth hormones for their cows so that it doesn't end up in the milk that Ben and Jerry's makes their ice cream with. But right below that, you'll see a statement that they are required by the FDA to put on there that says the FDA doesn't show any difference. We'd like that to stop. We just want labeling that says either it's genetically engineered or it's not. They have it in England. They have it in France. We want it here. So we have the choice between genetically engineered food and food that's not genetically engineered food. What's scary about genetic engineering technology and what's scary about the DNA that they're messing with in there is that it does spread by wind or pollen, so that people who are growing organic ingredients eventually, in a few years, if we don't stop it now, those will be genetically engineered too. And you won't know the difference between organic food and non-organic food and what's genetically engineered and what's not. That's really what these companies are hoping for, and that's what I'm fighting against.
What kind of concrete plans do you have for the next stage in the battle?
Well, we're going to be doing a protest at Cornell University, and we want to really get the message out to the people, handing out flyers and leaflets and giving them places where they can go and find out real information before they get hit with a barrage of lies, basically, from the genetic engineering companies and the biotechnology companies like Novartis and Monsanto and DuPont Chemical. We're calling it the Genetic Engineered Food Information Campaign because we want people to find out about it on their own. There's plenty of places you can go and get information, and we want to get that information out. We want to hand out flyers and leaflets, hold signs, carry banners, dress in costume. We really just want to get the information out so that people know what's going on, know what they're eating. So we're going to be doing that. That's really the second information campaign that we've held this year. The first one was at Wegmans in Pittsford Plaza in Rochester, New York, and Wegmans, and they do have genetic engineered ingredients in their food, in the food you feel good about, and Tops has it in the food that Walter recommends, and we want to get those out of their store brands. We want them labeled on the store shelves. We'd like both Wegmans and Tops to let us know through signs or through pamphlets what food is genetically engineered and what is not. So every Sunday in July, we'll be doing a campaign at a Tops and a Wegmans somewhere in New York to get that information out right into the grocery shoppers' hands.
How will people know, how to get a hold of you or where this is happening if they want to participate in this?
If you want to participate directly, there's a phone number you can call. You can contact the Rochester Fishberries, And you can call them at 716-461-1071. They're also, they have email there, fishberries, that's fishberries at hotmail.com. And you can contact the Ithaca Safe Food Campaign. They are in Ithaca. They're at P.O. Box 634, Ithaca, New York, 14851. And you can contact us. If you want to participate in this upcoming protest, you can call 716-271-3003 for more information. That is the number for Ground Score. And you can also contact us on the internet. You can go to www.groundscore.org. That's groundscore.org. And you can email us at news@groundscore.org. And there's just literally tons of places that you can also go on the internet and write to find out more information about genetically engineered food. If you want to participate in the protests that are coming up in July, every Sunday in July at Wegmans and Tops grocery stores, again, that number for Ground Score is 716-271-3003.
That was Eric Bradshaw of Ground Score. We'll post the numbers and internet addresses he mentioned on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. For those not familiar with the Cornell campus, there's a flyer with a map that you can download. The protests against GMOs will take place next Friday and Saturday, June 16th and 17th, at Kennedy Hall on the Cornell campus in Ithaca, which is located on Garden Avenue near the Biotech building. The protests will be going on all day, so come by anytime Friday between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. or on Saturday from 8 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.